I am happy to hear that there's been some services found for him. I know that in pediatrics that can be a challenge, especially if you're a clinic, people leave, filling them, finding good fits for a variety of reasons with our pediatric population. So I am glad to hear his services are up and running for him. But I agree. I can't. I'm having a hard time connecting with a breach of our practice act.
There is a point made here, too, that therapy hours were able to be increased from Ms. Holem's recommendations.
Excellent.
When they did return to a different facility. So I'm leaning towards really being just not the best fit and not really substandard care.
I do acknowledge Dr. Muldoon's statement that often, you know, progress is not necessarily at the predictable linear rate.
Yes.
And so I do feel like changes in care can contribute to stalls or maybe a plateau in progress until that care can be reestablished somewhere else. So I could see this being a difficult situation. But I also do feel that it is not a therapeutic relationship for the patient in where optimal gains could be made, as there seems to be just some disagreement in terms of goals.
So,
plan of care.
I'm definitely not a pediatric therapist. So is this like what Lohem saw was exactly what the child was like, but that doesn't mean that a month later under somebody else that's when things started moving. But so that can we have both records correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would say so.
Yeah.
Well, maybe for my sake as a public member.
Can you speak up?
For my sake as a public member, maybe you guys could address how it seems that the expectation on the initial evaluation and what the child is progressing now is so off. How could somebody be that off?
I guess what I'm feeling is that when someone has variable performance for whatever reason, if they have some other conditions or if they have breaks from therapy, that's why it's that much more important in my view to have an agreement between the plan of care and the goals of the parent and the physical therapist. And I feel like since that didn't occur here, it was not a good therapeutic relationship.
Yeah.
And as but that doesn't necessarily mean it was substandard care in my view.
We also have to remember that it was an initial evaluation versus an ongoing relationship between the therapist and the child. When, like for any patient, the first time I see someone, I only have what I have from that moment and potentially reviewing prior progress notes. But every relationship, right, is different, and I wouldn't necessarily jump to it a miss. I think it was just it sounds as though as I'm reading it, it's like determining, you know, how what your relationship's gonna be like based on like the first time you ever meet someone. And in pediatrics, particularly, it can be very challenging. I had many kids come to me from other places, and I'm sure left my practice to go to another place because we, you know, vision or goals or progress had you know, the parent was seeking something different. No, no right or wrong, just different.
Any further discussion? We have a motion. We have a second. Is there any further discussion in order for you to feel comfortable in how you want to vote? If no further discussion, then let's call the vote.
So the motion before you is to dismiss complaint 1846. Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Ms. Hunter?
Yes.
Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwell?
Yes.
Ms. Remick?
Yes.
Mr. Clinton?
No.
The motion passes. The complaint is dismissed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's move to item 4B, case 18-14, Amy Brannon.
Dr. Cornwell, the council has provided additional materials that are sitting over here. I'd like to be able to distribute, and you may want to take a short break to review them.
Okay.
It is 10:22.
Dr. Cornwell, your meeting.
And Dr. Cornwell, members of the board, based on the voluminous amount of information that you received today, the board would always have the option to continue this informal hearing to next month to provide the board with adequate time to review it unless you feel that you already have.
Mm-hmm. It looks like most of it was previously provided.
I mean, a lot of it was, but to the extent that you need additional time, that is an option.
Okay. All right. We'll call this matter to, all right, this is item number 4B, case number 18-14, Amy Brannon, physical therapist. Let's have the board members and council introduce themselves.
Joshua Greer, public member.
Peggy Hunter, professional member.
Kelly Keane, professional member.
Karen Bustillo, professional member.
Mark Cornwell, professional member.
Nishka Remick, professional member.
Michael Clinton, public member.
Mona Baskin, assistant attorney general representing the board.
Karen Donahue, executive director.
Monica Crowley, licensing administrator.
Okay. Would you please introduce, each of you, introduce yourself?
I'm Dr. Amy Brannon, physical therapist.
Nick Mesa, counsel for Dr. Brannon.
Okay. This interview is being held pursuant to ARS 32-2046. The purpose of an informal hearing is to hear relevant facts by way of testimony and exhibits to determine if a violation of any of the board's statutes or rules has occurred. If the board finds a violation, it may take any or all of the following disciplinary action. One, issue a decree of censure. Two, place restrictions upon a licensee's practice. Three, issue a civil penalty of not more than $500. Issue other disciplinary action. Five, issue a non-disciplinary order requiring completion of continuing education as specified by the board. If the board finds the violation or possible violation of statute or rule is not sufficiently serious to warrant disciplinary action, the board may issue a non-disciplinary advisory letter. If the board finds that there was no violation of the board's statutes and rules, the board may dismiss the case. If the board finds that the violations warrant suspension or revocation of the license, the board shall vote the matter to a formal hearing. Okay. We might as well put everybody under oath, right?
Correct.
So all those who are going to testify, please raise your right hand. Okay. You swear and solemnly swear to tell the truth and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Okay.
And then, Dr. Cornwell, if you could identify the witnesses that she swore in for the record.
The only one that I know of is herself.
Okay, and then you had your investigator.
Mindy, yes.
Okay, Mindy Richardson and the respondent in the case.
Okay.
Dr. Brand.
Right. Let's have a brief overview of the complaint.
complaint 1814 was in response to a physical therapy student written complaint. The student alleged that Ms. Brandon did not perform an initial examination prior to treatment, asked the student to copy and paste previous evaluations into a new patient record, and requested the student to document tests that were not performed as if Ms. Brandon had performed them.
Okay. So would you or your attorney like to make an opening statement?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Hello, members of the board. Again, I'm Amy Brannon. I'd like to thank you all for your time and attention to this matter and the opportunity to speak with you. I apologize if I'm nervous, but this is still very emotional and nerve-wracking for me, so please bear with me. I've been a licensed as a physical therapist in Arizona since 2008. In over a decade of practice until this matter, I've never received a complaint from a patient, colleague, or a student. However, as the board is aware, I'm here today because a former student filed a complaint and made allegations against me and my practice that I take very seriously. This process has been very upsetting to me, and these allegations are exceptionally hurtful. However, I've gained a new perspective and insight on myself as a clinician and as a CI. This event has allowed me to reflect, analyze, and think about my care as a physical therapist. Above all, this experience has allowed me to understand how I can improve as a clinician and as an instructor, particularly in areas of communication and documentations, and I've already taken steps in this regard by completing a documentation and a CI advanced course in November and December, respectively. I'm someone who's very passionate for my profession and who tries to give back to my community as much as possible. I truly enjoy coming to work every single day. I take pride in my career and my relationships with my patients, including being able to properly educate them and help improve their lives and physical health within my clinic and when they're at home. Not only do I love being able to educate my patients, but I also love having students with me in a symbiotic relationship of learning. As anyone who has served as a CI knows, it's a labor of love. I do it because I have a personal belief that's my responsibility to contribute to the future of our profession, one that I absolutely love. It is a fun process being able to teach students real clinical application of didactic information that they have learned. In turn, I enjoy having them teach me other techniques, research, et cetera, that they've learned in school or from other clinical sites. It's a two-way road that's always fun for me to engage in. At this time, 21 months after the date in question, it's difficult for me to remember the exact details of the day in question. However, I've gone through my notes, and to the best of my recollection, I spoke with patient HR the day before treatment and discussed her current status. During our conversation, HR was questioning if I could help her since she was having some slight discomfort in her neck and back due to her extensive training programs. It's important to know that HR is a very extremely active person. She frequently competes in marathons, races, half marathons, etc., and I've worked and treated her as she's trained for these events. During my conversation with her, I suggest that she come in for an evaluation and treatment so we could help her and minimize the potential for future injury. We had and continue to have a relationship where she pushes herself to a physical extreme, and I help to safely maintain her ability to push as hard as she desires in a manner that is as safe as possible. Upon her arrival, she greeted the clinic dog and sat with him on the ground. I observed her motions and noted that she presented with a hitch in her motions of her neck and back. She came to the table and we discussed where she felt that she had had some deficits. Then I performed an evaluation on her and included measuring her strength and range of motion, which is customarily done using a goniometer. After that, I started treatment. After performing interventions on any patient, including HR, I will typically recheck their complaints that brought them into the clinic to ensure that they received relief, thus continuing with the evaluation process. HR performed the exercises as listed in the record prior to leaving. As detailed in my supplemental response, I acknowledge that I did not provide thorough documentation during the visit. The note from March 15, 2018 does not detail the full scope of my evaluation, including my history and understanding of the patient or my communications with her the night before the visit. The note also does not provide information regarding why I believed a high-velocity, low-amplitude thrust was appropriate for the patient at the time. In short, in my professional judgment, given all the information I knew about the patient, I determined that the high-velocity, low-amplitude thrust was appropriate to get a neurophysiological release to the area of the patient's in-ring neck stiffness due to passive accessory motion at that time. This explanation was not noted in the record, and I know now that it should have been and improved my notes now to reflect that it says that. I also acknowledge that there are certain assessments and measurements that match injuries from the patient's prior visit. However, I categorically deny any allegation this information was copied and pasted or that I acted in a misleading or fraudulent manner. I know my practice and I stand by the record. If the record notes that a particular evaluation was done, it was done. Further, a close examination of the records show they are not identical. It clearly indicates that new assessments were performed. I did not provide treatment on my patients without knowing what needs to be treated, and it is my practice to test and measure their strength and range of motion with the appropriate instruments. Finally, it is not entirely unusual for the patient to have similar scores and measurements only a few months apart, especially if the patient had not been seen in between visits or the patient has failed to keep up with their at-home exercises. In sum, the issues here are due to my lapses in documentation, not dishonesty or fraud. That said, I absolutely know I can be a better clinician and instructor, and I've taken steps on this front. I've changed my personal documentation habits to be more thorough and completed a documentation course with Dr. Donahue in November 2019 with one of my employees. I now document with the purpose of ensuring another clinician is able to pick up my records at any given time and know exactly what evaluation and treatments were performed and why. I was able to get feedback in the course that the new documentation provided was much improved from the previous documentation. I revised our clinic's policies and procedures regarding documentation. I performed an internal review based on the November 2019 course and recommendation and subsequently held a staff meeting to update them on the new practices December 10, 2019. As a CI, I have changed as well, now emphasizing communication within the clinic and setting expectations for the beginning of the student's rotation. This past weekend, I took the advanced CI clinical course, and it's taught me how to have an unconditional positive regard for each and every single student, even when they are challenging. Meaning, I need to show respect, continuously evaluate the student, plan, and remain objective with them. I recognize that my effective domain of learning was lacking, and I'm thankful for the awareness in this category. I also make it a point to provide more explicit feedback or conversations with students moving forward. I set aside formal meeting times to go over the student progress. I'm more diligent in reviewing emails and communications from my students and directors of clinical education. And as a demonstration for the commitment to improving as a CI, as I said this weekend, I flew to California and completed the APTA's advanced CI certification course. Overall, I've learned the importance of the detailed documentation, how much I need to make a change in my practice for students to better learn and thrive in a high-performance patient environment. I hope you'll consider the information that I've provided to you as well as my voluntary completion of the documentation and CI courses. I've mulled over the situation for the past 21 months and have certainly changed my clinical practices, student engagement, and documentation to ensure this doesn't happen again. You have my word. I've punished myself tremendously over this complaint. It'll be an example to my fellow colleagues and future students on much improved clinical practices. Thank you.
Okay. Members of the board, if I may add just two quick points. The packets you received today, the only new information in there was a timeline that set forth kind of the timeline of events and three letters from patients that are currently treated by Dr. Brandon, who are high-level first responders who speak to her character here in this particular instance. I would also like to note the affidavit was provided in advance. The affidavit is from the patient. It very clearly notes that Dr. Brandon has treated her for approximately 3 years for a number of injuries. And again, she states very clearly in that affidavit that she does recall an evaluation being performed on the key areas that are at issue here, measurements being taken. And again, she speaks to Dr. Brandon's high level of care and expertise throughout her 3 years and your 3 years of having seen this particular patient. So with that, I just want to add those two things.
All right. So open it up for board members to ask questions.
Go ahead.
So when you took the ProTec, which, by the way, is given by Peggy Heller, not Karen Donahue. I mean, I know she's present, but the documentation course is by Peggy Heller.
Okay,
so just want to make that. So can you tell me, because there are a lot of documentation questions in the report, mm-hmm. can you tell me personally what you learned from that course?
There are many different things that I learned in different avenues of the initial examination and a lot of it was I was doing more single plane physiological movements, and I've learned that I need to do more accessory movement explanations in my documentation. And so we discussed that. I spoke mostly with Peg Hiller when we were going over our documentation review, and I was able to provide two different forms of documentation. And it seems as if that's where I was lacking, and there were many opportunities where I had negative testing that I did not put the negative testing in, that I was only doing my positive testing that was in there. And so I've learned that I need to be more thorough in that. And then as far as explicitly stating the manual work that was done, as far as the direction that we're going with the pressure, what we're doing with the different mobilizations, you know, exactly the body parts, sets, reps, et cetera. So those were the things that I felt was more implied prior to this, and I completely understand the importance for another therapist to understand, you know, for doing it. And I do a lot of it based on feel, and I recognize that I needed to be more aware of the reps that I was doing at that point in time to then make it more explicit for the next therapist.
Right, because I'm pretty sure just by the report that you know your patients very well, mm-hmm. and you may go to your report and read it and know, you know, what you meant to say. But for instance, if I walked into your clinic and went to read the notes, I probably wouldn't have a clue. Well, I would have a clue, but not as well as you.
And I think I misjudged if I were to get into a car accident or if something were to happen to me, the next person stepping in and being able to take care of that. So I recognize the importance of doing so.
In regards to that, did you learn anything from any of these courses as it related to the student that you had that you might have not done correctly or mm-hmm. not as much?
Yes. What I think I learned the best from this was that there's a cognitive aspect, a psychomotor aspect, and then there's the, you know, the when I'm sitting there understanding emotions, et cetera, and I believe that I have a very good ability to communicate with students and be able to correct those things, but it's more of the personality or bedside manner, et cetera, that I was challenged with. And so I discussed that with the people who are putting on the course and had them do some role playing with me explicitly. You know, I mean, we've had some issues of people showing up with poor dress uniform, et cetera. And so being able to confront it more objectively and being able to do that. So I believe that my cognitive and psychomotor, I had the ability to do more confrontation with that. And when it came to more of the, you know, personality, bedside manner, et cetera, that I struggled with that. And so I've learned how to do that much better now.
All right. Thank you, ma'am.
Yes.
I want to talk about what happened on March 15th, 2018, 21 months ago.
Okay.
And you said you mulled over it. I've been thinking about it for a long time. What do you remember when HR came in?
What I've stated in the notes is what I remember as far as, you know, I can remember seeing observationally what she was moving, and I can remember, and it would be customary for me to do the evaluation. Again,
And let's stop there. Do you remember doing the evaluation, or just it's so customary that you specifically sitting here today remember doing the evaluation on HR on March 13th?
I cannot remember specifically that moment in time, no.
Do you remember where Ms. Kinkelfitz was? Is that her name?
Yes.
Yeah.
In relation to inside my clinic?
When she got there, do you remember where she was when she got there?
Generally, they would be side by side with me, but I cannot remember specifically if she was standing. It's an open clinic, so I don't have closed rooms, and so she would be right there at the table with me, yes.
So she would have been with you when you did the measurements?
Correct.
Okay.
But it is potential for her to have a visual field of other distracting things in the clinic.
How long does it take you to do those measurements?
I mean, it would take for me to go through all of them, especially because she had been through them before. I don't have to explicitly describe. I can ask her, you know, to go through some of those motions. It would be 5 minutes or so to get physical measurements.
Is it possible that Mrs. Kinkelfitz just missed it somehow?
I believe so, yes.
And how would that happen? She just wasn't paying attention? She's standing right next to you, or would you have her do something else while you were doing those measurements? I'm trying to figure out, because what happened, the timeline is rather troubling. Because
yes, yes.
This happened on March 15th, and she files a complaint 4 days later.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out, if it didn't happen, if she was right there next to you when this met, what would cause this student to lie, really, is what you're saying. Is she was right there next to me. She was there when I did it, and now she's just lying. And I'm trying to figure out what happened there, because generally in my experience, people don't just lie for no reason. And so I'm going to ask you to guess what she's thinking now, but I'm trying to think, did she miss it, or what happened?
It's quite possible, yes. It was as baffling, and I was blindsided when I got this as well, to be honest with you. I don't know. Like I said, there's an open clinic, so if someone was doing an exercise and she was focused on maybe poor mechanics and wanting to go over and correct that and wasn't paying attention to explicitly what I was doing, as she stated in her investigative interview as well, I generally write down my stuff on a piece of paper, and then when I sit at a computer, then I transcribe that stuff over. So, I mean, again, yes, it's customary for me to write down all those measurements on that piece of paper so then I can, you know, later put it into the computer exactly what it was. So I was as blindsided, and for me it's frustrating that there was no communication back to me as far as questioning why that would be the case. So I'm not sure if it was a personality conflict, and use this as an example, I don't know. But there was no conversation to me to know.
Is it possible that you forgot to do the measurements with this patient? Did you know her? She's someone you're familiar with. You talked to her the night before. Is it possible that you just...
It would not be normal practice for me to do so. And I mean, I don't know how I would treat something if I don't know what the deficit is. Right? So I'm not sure how I could be able to take someone into some type of treatment if I didn't know where the deficit was. If I didn't palpate to see that there's tight muscles somewhere, if I didn't see them move, then I wouldn't know. I always test and retest. I go through the motion. I do my intervention. And I mean, especially, you know, if you do like a total knee range of motion, every session they come in, you're measuring to try and motivate them to improve their range of motion. So
it wouldn't be, you don't remember, but it would be highly irregular if you wouldn't have done them.
Yeah, correct. Yes, sir.
Is there any bad blood between you and Ms. Kankelpitz?
At this time, I really, like I said, at that time, there was not bad blood. I just feel that the communication, and I also feel that the personality issue between patients and her, there was not a vibe. There certainly was not. And I've had over 50 students, and I hadn't had somebody who had that type of personality differential. I think that the DCEs are very good at placing students in clinics that are appropriate for students to thrive. And for some reason, this personality, I just feel there was something that didn't jive with us. And I know that she was interested in attending her CrossFit classes. And so I know my schedule is very challenging since I start at 6 a.m. That, you know, it's sometimes challenging for people who are not morning people or who have other things that they do in the morning prior to going to work. I don't know.
Dr. Brandon, Vera, can you clarify, too, as you noted, with respect to the schedule issue, and I think our previous appearance, you noted this, but can you speak to the issues with respect to the early start time? Mm-hmm. And then again, your perception, which I think is supported by the interview that was conducted about Ms. Kankelfin's, her desire to have autonomy right off the bat, mm-hmm. and your practice approach.
Yes, thank you for the reminder. There was, as I was stating, a scheduling challenge, and she wanted to change her hours, and it just wasn't appropriate for the clinic at the time, and those are my hours for working, so those were the hours that were set. With that said as well, she did, and in her paperwork that was sent to us prior to doing treatment, it said that she preferred to do things on her own because she gets nervous when somebody is overwatching. Unfortunately, that's just not the way I am in my setting. And so for me, doing high-performance people, and again, she was there for 10 days, so perhaps towards the end, absolutely, or you know, into a couple of weeks once I had more time with her, I could have allowed her to do more autonomous treatment. But at the time, it really was not appropriate for me to do so because as far as the personality, I start, like I said in my response, I usually start and have them get comfortable with the patients by teaching them exercises and just getting that rapport with the patients so that the patient's comfortable with them performing manual work, et cetera. Because a lot of these patients, when a student comes in, they're jumping in mid-treatment. And so, you know, it's like, I have a student now. And some of them love it, and some of them are just concerned. And so with that said, I can't just have her jump in and do autonomous treatment at that point in time. So I feel that I am involved, and I was involved, and there was conflict with that as well. which was brought more to light when it came to the investigative interview once I read it. So I recognize that was a challenge.
And one more point of clarification again. The complaint was on site for approximately 10 days. And in the investigative interview, there are multiple comments that state, quote, Dr. Brannon wasn't letting me do anything. So, again, we don't know what the motivations may have been, but there was clearly personality conflicts, and there was clearly a level of dissatisfaction from the student, whatever that may be. But it's our belief that it was part of the scheduling issue, part of the autonomy issue, and that's why we're here today.
With regard to the note, did Ms. Kankelfitz, did she create the initial note that you then reviewed? How was that note created?
Yes. So the student has, at my clinic, the student has the, there's a student login. Yeah, yes. And so Ms. Kankelfitz could log into her own initial evaluation, initiate the process, which is something that we would have them transfer over the demographics, et cetera, so that they learn about the patient, so that they're more familiar with patients that we are already familiar with, to help them understand what they've been in before for treatment.
Do you remember what instructions you gave her when transferring over information?
Again, I can't remember specifically, but it's customary for me to, you know, say this is something that we do as a chart review, essentially, but it becomes a productive chart review where they transfer over the demographic data, et cetera. And then from there, I go in, which you can see in the notes that we time-stamped at different times, and put in more information that would, and, you know, 2 weeks, and I don't expect her to be able to document thoroughly anyway, so I would always probably have something to add in or put into the note as well.
So is it possible that she just misunderstood what stuff she was supposed to be transferring over?
Absolutely. And furthermore, that's something that I've learned very much language-wise, to make sure that I inform the students with that. And as of, so she was there in March of 2018. As of November of 2018, that became an automated process that the system already does.
Mm-hmm. And so it's possible that she misunderstood you, what she's supposed to be transferring over. She did something else when the measurements were taken. And there's a little bit of hostility between the two for lots of reasons, and basically just a whole misunderstanding.
Yes, that a simple conversation between us would have been, and to be contacted by the DCE as well. There was no alarming emails. There was no conversation. The day that she left, she said she was going out to lunch with her aunt, mm-hmm. and then just never returned.
Well, I think it's fairly understood. The day she left, she was very uncomfortable.
Yes, yes.
Whether rightfully so or wrong.
Right, but there's just
she was obviously uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable,
she turned
absolutely.
Around and
absolutely.
Filed a complaint.
Complaint, right. So.
Mr. Garrett, I'd also like to add as well, Dr. Brannon spoke to the functionality on WebPT about an automated kind of data transfer. That functionality was implemented later on down the line.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm. In the investigative file, the report, Ms. Kankelfitz very clearly stated that she had never used WebPT before. So I think that's a very important thing to note, in that miscommunication or something lost in translation, when that functionality, that instruction to transfer over key information, may have been given by Dr. Brannon to the student, perhaps that interpretation was, you know, blown out of proportion.
I'm a little confused. I mean, this was your student. You're a clinical instructor. Did you meet with the student every day to discuss things that happened in the clinic?
Yes. And
none of this was ever brought up?
No, ma'am. And we sit side by side to document. We go through every patient that we're going to see. And again, I don't have a schedule for myself and a schedule for the students. It is just my schedule that they help, you know, out with, or once we get to the point where they can do independent treatment, I allow them to. Mm-hmm. And so that is something that we are side by side and discuss everything we're going to do. And if a patient comes late or runs over, or someone comes early, maybe we don't discuss it, but there wouldn't be a half a day, because then I have a 30-minute time slot prior to the lunch for documentation, and we sit side by side where we could discuss these types of things. And then at the end of the day, again, there's a 30-minute time slot prior to the end of the day. And I mean, even as she stated in the investigative interview, I'm always there early and late, so I'm not quick to leave. you know, I'm not somebody that's rushing out. I eat lunch at work every single day. So, I mean, I sit at my desk and do documentation during lunch as well.
So when the student, when Ms. K walked out, did you contact Ms. Beerwas?
Well, initially we didn't know what was going on. She didn't return, so we called her three times with no response. As we were looking for the emergency contact in her paperwork, it was at that time Ms. Beerwas called and said that she would not be returning and talked to the front office. And so then, because I had moved on to the rest of my schedule, because now we're talking after lunch had resumed and I was with my patients, and then Ms. Beerwas called, and so then we were in confusion, so I called Ms. Beerwas back, and she just said that, you know, perhaps we could have a lunch at a later date, which, again, that was prior to any of this being brought up.
Okay.
So there was no alarm bells. There were no red flags. There was nothing that was brought to my attention until I got the complaint.
All right. Thank you, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Dr. Brandon, I am pleased to see that you attended a documentation course. I think as challenging as this situation has been for you with the student,
it needed
your
to be
documentation.
Done. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, leaves a lot to be desired.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would love to hear what you learned and how you've changed your practice in writing a discharge summary. Because your prior
yes.
ones were like a single statement, didn't
yes.
address goals or plan, just doing better and busy with school. And that
mm-hmm.
was on both of your discharge summaries.
So with that specifically, actually, was a very interesting conversation, as most of our patients will self-discharge, and we end up contacting them later with a phone call and just check in with them. Or a lot of times if I'm doing a ride-along, et cetera, I'll see some of these guys out on in their job, and I'm like, hey, are you coming back? You haven't seen you in a while. So anyways, we're not able to do a formal discharge oftentimes because they are back to doing their activities pain-free, and they didn't need to be back. And so with that said, what we have now done is created a template where we do their start date, end date, from therapy, the number of sessions that they had within that encounter, where they were, you know, their status outcome at that point in time, mm-hmm. and then any form of progress that we had noted. And if we are able to talk to them, if we call and leave a message, we try and wait for a call back. If we don't hear back from them, then we, you know, we say that in the discharge summary. But then otherwise, if we do hear back from them, we put the summary of what the patient said on the phone call.
Perfect. Do you have a set time frame? Like, because sometimes these were several weeks between sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a set time frame that if we don't see a patient, hear mm-hmm. from a patient, whatever, that we automatically will discharge that patient from our services?
Within 2 to 4 weeks. So usually at the 2-week time window, we are trying to call the patient and just check in and see how they are doing and why they have not resumed in that 2-week time period. But for sure by that 4-week time period, we are making sure that we're doing those discharge summaries. So we give the patient the opportunity to call back.
Thank you.
You made it in your opening statement, you said that in your documentation, if you said you did it, you did it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that the converse is true. If you didn't put it in there, you didn't do it?
I hear what you're saying, yes, and that was what I learned in the documentation, that in the documentation course, is that that is what stands to be true. And so I'm learning that I need to put all of the negative testing, et cetera, that I did not document into the notes.
So help me understand why it took you a complaint to the board for you to be introspective towards your documentation. I mean, this implies that if the student hadn't complained, you'd still have really crappy documentation.
Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying. I think part of it comes from the fact that I started with written documentation, and I feel that as we've gone into these EMRs, there's so much more minutia in the computer, and so I believe that, which I wrongly believe that some of the click boxes were more things that you could get information into the note, and I now understand that you need to type a lot more into those areas. So I honestly think, along with the jurisprudence exam, you should be required to take this documentation course regardless, because I think it was a very, and I will continue to take it every couple of years, because I think that there are things that I maybe had missed from that course as well. I think it was a very well done course, and I feel that all of my staff members need to take it, and we need to continuously remind ourselves. I think that just over time, my experience got the best of me.
Relative to HR, you saw her back in December of 17, right?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And then she came back in March.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears to me that you had a long enough history with her that you kind of knew what her problems were, mm-hmm. and that they probably hadn't been, they hadn't changed a whole lot from December to March, mm-hmm. right? Because she still had lower extremity weakness, which appears to be mostly in around the hips and pelvis, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, sir.
So, but you described her as highly motivated, mm-hmm. and that she tends to overdo things, right?
Yes, sir.
So why do you think her strength didn't increase between December and March?
I believe that she continued with doing similar activities to what she had previously been doing, and that she came in and just got the quick fix it, feel better, and go back. She does about 3 workouts per day. Sundays are a day for her to go do 90-minute runs minimum, and then she's out hiking. And I mean, she teaches fitness classes along with being a teacher. And so if she had some type of deficit, if she did not maintain what she was doing, I believe that's part of the reason why those strength deficits would be.
So all the things that she does for activity, hiking and running, those are not sufficient for her to maintain adequate hip abduction strength?
I believe that if she had the hip abduction weakness on both sides and was not strengthening that frontal plane and just kept doing more sagittal plane activities, that yes, her frontal plane would continue to be weak without doing any type of strengthening for that.
And you think she didn't follow through with the exercises? Is that what?
That's my belief, yes.
Because if somebody that active shouldn't have maintained four and a half out of five from one visit to the next, unless there's something else going on that you've completely missed, mm-hmm. or she's lying to you. She says she does the exercises. She says she does all these activities, but she's not. Okay. Or what she needs instead of exercises, she needs actually some neuromuscular training on the hip. So, but none of that is in your note. There's mm-hmm. nothing in there to help you. I'm questioning, why in the world would you think that that's not strange, that in December she's got weakness, and in March she's got weakness, essentially in the same muscles, and you're not going to address that? I'm having a hard time figuring out. To me, it looks like you really did do exactly what she wanted. She wanted the quick fix, and she didn't want to have a real correction in her musculoskeletal system. Mm-hmm.
I believe I can give her the tools to do so, but if she does not do that, then I feel that we are that fallback. A lot of times that happens with a lot of patients. If you give them their home programs and they're not compliant, they come back and you're like, here we are. Why? You know, what happened?
Did you have that conversation with her?
I can't remember that day, but I likely did, yes.
I mean, you've seen her an awful lot. Have you ever had that conversation with her?
Absolutely, yes, yes. And this is something.
Has been?
If there's a complication with her having eating disorder and using food as exercise to offset some of that. So with that said, I've had those conversations that sometimes she has to back off of her exercise and in the endurance side to then work on some of the strengthening so that we aren't getting the pain during the endurance. But some of that, I believe, is put to the wayside with some of the more complications psychologically.